This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other courses or to access other materials from RTS, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For information on how you may obtain a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree online, please visit us at virtual.rts.edu.
All right, lecture 7. We begin to make our way through Genesis chapters 4 through 11. Genesis chapter 4, the powerful effect of sin is displayed in the enmity between the two seeds. So the enmity that was talked about in chapter 3, we now begin to see worked out in history and in relationships. You have the story of Cain and Abel. Very familiar story, I'm sure. This is the first outworking of the conflict between the two seeds with sin triumphing here. Now, you know, Cain was a tiller of the ground. Abel was a keeper of sheep. They each bring their offerings to God. Cain's offering is not accepted. So, one of the major questions that always arises, why is the offering of Cain rejected? Some argue that it was rejected because it was not a blood sacrifice. And I do think there's some plausibility to this view. You go back to Genesis chapter 2, and there's certainly the implication there that God covers the nakedness of Adam and Eve with animal skins. There's the implication there of the shedding of blood. You have the whole sacrificial system that develops that we'll talk about in Leviticus, and the indispensable role of blood in the sacrificial system. You have the passage in Hebrews that says, without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sins. So I do think you can make a plausible argument that the reason God rejects Cain's offering is because it wasn't a blood sacrifice, although I'm not totally convinced that that's the reason. Let me say why. The word that is used for their offering, in verse 3, Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord respected Abel and his offering. He did not respect Cain and his offering. The word used for offering is the Hebrew. H with a dot under it always has that sound, guttural sound. Sorry about that, Mike. So this would be mincha. That's the particular Hebrew term used. It's used of both offerings, both Cain's and Abel's. This is the term that will become used for the grain offering in Leviticus chapter 2. It is a term that stresses something that is brought as a gift or a tribute. And the grain offering is an acceptable offering without the shedding of blood. So, because of the use of this term, I'm not totally convinced that the fact that Abel brought from the fruit of the ground and it wasn't a blood offering is the reason that God rejected it. Because there are other offerings of the fruit of the ground that people bring to God later in Scripture. It's possible that there's something to the fact that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground, and that when it talks about Abel's offering, it says he brought of the firstborn of his flock. Now maybe Abel brings the firstborn, which is considered the best. It doesn't say Cain brought of the first fruits. That may be a factor. If that is a factor, I think it goes back to what the basic issue really is here, and that's the attitude of the heart. I think the attitude of the heart is the basic reason why God rejects Cain's offering. Now, you could say it's because of his attitude of the heart that he didn't bring a blood sacrifice, so you could still get that in there. But certainly the attitude of the heart is key. And the New Testament puts emphasis on faith as being the deciding difference between the two. Chapter Hebrews 11:4, by faith, Abel offered a better sacrifice than Cain. So, you know, whether or not it had anything to do with the sacrifice itself, maybe it did. Certainly it all goes back to the attitude of the heart. It was Cain's attitude of heart that was the reason God did not accept his sacrifice. And that sort of is evidenced by his response. His response is a response of anger, because God did not accept his sacrifice. That anger shows his heart's condition. He wasn't willing to sort of submit to God, but he becomes angry. And so God confronts him in chapter 4, verse 7, and lays out his options. Why are you angry? 4:6. Why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do not do well, sin lies at the door. It's desirous for you, you should rule over it. Cain has the opportunity to do good, to respond correctly in this situation. But his anger leads to murder. And so sin triumphs with the murder of Abel. And as a result, there is an intensification of the curse in Cain. If you compare the curse in Genesis 3 and the curse here, there is an intensification of the curse. So that Cain's punishment really becomes greater in many ways than Adam's. Adam and Eve shifted blame. Cain just outright denial. Chapter 4, verse 9, the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel your brother? I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? No shifting of blame, just outright denial. Cain is addressed directly in terms of the curse. You are cursed, 4:11 says. See, that was only said of the serpent in Genesis chapter 3. You are cursed. It was said of Adam, the ground is cursed. But here, you are cursed. Now we see in chapter 4, verse 12, that the ground will not yield its strength to Cain. You know, Adam would toil and work hard, and the ground would yield some fruit. But verse 12 says, when you till the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. A fugitive and a vagabond you shall be on the earth. The ground will not yield its strength to Cain, and so Cain will be a wanderer, wandering around the earth. There's also a loss of belonging and a loss of identification with the community. In fact, there's alienation from God, very clearly stressed in 4:14, where Cain says, you've driven me out this day from the face of the ground. I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond on the earth. I think what you have here is a separation of Cain and his line from the community. Because he murders Abel, because of his act of murdering Abel, there's now a separation from God, alienation from God, and a separation of that community. So you have a division here between the godly line and the ungodly line. And Cain and his descendants are going to be representative of the ungodly line. And we will pick up the godly line at the end of chapter 4. Cain says to God, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Anyone who finds me will kill me. He's afraid now that there will be revenge. Sort of the idea of the avenger of blood, where a relative might take it upon himself to avenge the death of a family member. And so even when the children of Israel get into the land of Canaan, and let's say you're out in the field, and an accident happens, and something happens where you kill somebody else, well, you make a beeline to the city of refuge. Because if the avenger of blood gets to you before you get to the city of refuge, you might be done with. But you get to the city of refuge, and then at the city of refuge, you sort of hash things out in terms of what happened. So this is sort of the idea of the avenger of blood. Cain is afraid that someone may take vengeance on him because he has murdered Abel. So he says at the end of verse 14, "It will happen that anyone who finds me will kill me." And the Lord said to him, "Therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." And the Lord set a mark on Cain, lest anyone finding him should kill him. Now, I don't know what the mark of Cain is. All kinds of speculations, talk about speculation, all kinds of suggestions have been made, all the way from a tattoo, a special hairstyle, a dog to protect him. I don't know. So we'll have to wait and find out later what the mark is. But he goes out from the presence of the Lord, and he dwells in the land of Nod, a word that has associations with wandering. And you have the development then in the rest of chapter 4 of the ungodly line. And it's very interesting, what you see develop in the ungodly line is the beginnings of civilization and culture. Cain in 417 builds a city. Some have identified the city as maybe the mark. Rick Salehammer does that. You have Jabal described in 420. Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock, husbandry, animal husbandry here. Jubal, 421. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the harp and flute. And then 422, Tubal-Cain. As for Zilla, she also bore Tubal-Cain, an instructor of every craftsman in bronze and iron. These things are rooted in the cultural mandate: be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. And you see the development of civilization and culture in the ungodly line as a part of God's common grace. So the unbelievers who live in God's world many times get things right. Now, many times they get things wrong, okay? But there is this aspect of God's common grace. Unbelievers are not as bad as what they could be because they don't believe in Jesus. And they interact with God's world, and they do a lot of things that are very positive. I'm very happy for God's common grace. My neighbors aren't as bad as what they could be. I have fairly good neighbors. I'm not real sure. I did. Our neighbors have changed. That's why I'm hesitating. At one point, I knew my neighbors were unbelievers. But some of these new neighbors, I'm not quite sure yet. But God's common grace, the development of culture and civilization in the line of Cain. So the line of Cain displays technical ability, gifts given by God, but moral failure. Yes, sir. You mean who did Cain marry?
Yeah.
My answer to that question is that Cain married his sister. And if you look at the progression in Scripture, Abraham marries his half sister. And when you get over to Leviticus, you can't do that anymore, because the law forbids you to marry your half-sister, like Abraham did. So I think there's a progression. I think God built it in. I don't know this for sure, but Who else could have came? Married. If Adam and Eve were the only, and are our ancestors, then they had to marry one of their sisters. And I just think God genetically must have built it in there very early that this would not have been a problem. And so you see, as the history develops, you then see God sort of laying down some regulations, which we'll get to in Leviticus, that says, no, you can no longer marry within these certain family relationships. So I don't have any problems saying Cain married a sister, although some people sort of ask that question, trying to trip you up, you know. But in light of the development of this, a lot of things are going on early on, and we have no idea, and God must have built it into the genetic thing that it wasn't a problem, as it is much more of a problem today if we marry within that close confines. Now, with technical ability but moral failure, you have the swift progression into sin in chapter 4 with Lamech. And Lamech's statement comes toward the end of chapter 4. You have the heightening effect of sin. Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, "Hear my voice, wives of Lamech, listen to my speech. I've killed a man for wounding me, even a young man for hurting me." You see, he kills somebody, he murders somebody for hardly any reason. And so there is some, and he boasts about it. And how many wives does he have? Two. What was God's original design? One. So you see the progression of sin and his disdain for life in this taunt song that he utters here. So you have the triumph of sin, Cain murders Abel, and then you have the progression and the development of sin demonstrated in Lamech's statement here. Now, at the end of chapter 4, we pick up the godly life. We've had a separation, clear separation now, but with the separation of Cain in his line, we pick up the godly line, and at the end of chapter 4, verse 25, the importance of seed comes back again. 4:25, Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and named him Seth, for God has appointed another seed. Now, if you look at the beginning of chapter 4, when it says, Adam knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, she said there, I've acquired an ish, a man, from the Lord. Here, verse 25, she uses the word zerah, seed, which we saw is very important in Genesis 3:15. So I think this is a significant statement. We're sort of picking up here on the godly line. Seth replaces Abel. Seth has a son. He names that son Enosh. Enosh is a term in Hebrew that can refer to man in his frail and weak condition. It sort of has that nuance to it. And so the emphasis on the seed. You also have in verse 26 a comment made about the worship of God. Very end of the verse, then men began to call on the name of the Lord. And it's the emphasis of worship that comes in context of the godly line. We've picked up the godly line again in verse 25. The seed concept is important, and now the concept of worship is mentioned at the end of chapter 4. That brings us then to the Toledot of Adam. Chapter 5, 1 through 6, 8. And chapter 5 begins with a summary statement that takes the reader back to creation. This is the book of the genealogy of Adam. The Toledot of Adam, in the day that God created Adam, man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female. and blessed them and called them mankind in the day they were created. So a summary statement talking about Adam and Eve and God's blessing on them. Part of that blessing are sons and daughters. And so you have this genealogy in chapter 5 that has a refrain scattered throughout the genealogy. You see it, where does it occur first time? Verse 7, does that occur first time, verse 7? Yeah. Verse 4. Yeah, verse 4. After he begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years, and he had sons and daughters. And you see this phrase, he had sons and daughters, he had sons and daughters, he had sons and daughters. Scattered throughout this genealogy. Part of the blessing of God in this family. However, the effect of the curse is also seen in chapter 5. In a phrase that occurs over and over again. And there's sort of a pattern here. And the first time this phrase occurs is in verse 5 of chapter 5. So all the days that Adam lived were 930 years. And he died. And you get this pattern. All the days that so-and-so lived were so many years. And he died. 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 Physical death comes on the scene as a result of the curse. Death. Death reigns. Is there any hope? Is there any escape? Well, you read through this genealogy, and a lot of times we don't read through the genealogies, do we? We kind of skip over them. But if you took the time to read through this genealogy, you would begin to see this pattern. He lived such and such years, and he died, and he died, and he died, and he died. And then you get over to verse 23. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years, and you expect, and he died. That's not what it says. The pattern is broken. It says in verse 24, and Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. Enoch breaks the rhythm of death. Death does not have a final word. And how is the rhythm of death broken? You walk with God. That's a fairly key phrase. It doesn't occur a lot in Genesis, but it does occur several times in Genesis. He walked with God. He found life amidst the curse of death. So that death doesn't have to have the last word. Now, obviously, this doesn't happen to everybody that walks with God. But this is given to us here as hope. That death does not reign. That there is life and there is hope. Even in the face of the pattern in this chapter, the pattern of death, and he died, and he died, and he died. There's also the possibility of hope in Noah. Noah's father was named Lamech. It's a different Lamech than the end of chapter 4. But if you look at verse 29, he called his name Noah, saying, this one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands. Now, why do we need comfort from work and the toil of our hands? It goes on to say, because of the ground which the Lord has cursed. There's a statement of hope. Maybe Noah is the one And there's a word play here between noach, which is sort of related to the Hebrew word for rest, and naham, which means comfort. And so there is a statement of hope. Maybe this is the one that will help us with relief from the curse. Now, Noah is an important figure. He will, in one way, help provide deliverance, won't he? Through the flood. And some associate planting of vineyards with Noah. And so maybe in a sense that brings some relief from the curse. I don't know exactly, but after the flood, he does plant some vineyards, and we'll talk about that when we get there. But they are looking. They understand the problem, and they are looking for someone that's been promised by God that will bring help and hope to them. And in chapter 5, this genealogy. It's not just a genealogy. There's two powerful statements here of hope with Enoch and with Noah. All right, that brings us to chapter 6. Yes.
In the Gospels, there's good reason to think that genealogies are not to be taken extremely literally. Maybe these
sometimes there are gaps.
Gaps. Good. Is this just overwhelmingly convincing that here this is a historical narrative, literal genealogy, or like the seventh generation of Enoch presumably could be it, or is that God's providence?
Well, I would say the genealogy of the Gospels are also literal. It's just how you understand A is this A begets B, or whatever it's stated. It's clear that it doesn't have to be father to son. It can be a descendant.
So, yes. It's sort of the same.
Well, this is the big debate. And somebody asked this question yesterday on the website, and I need to get some bibliography. This is the debate, the fact that these genealogies are connected to length of life. Does that make a difference for trying to come to some conclusion about the age of the earth? And so Usher comes to the conclusion that creation was, I think it's fairly specific, but 4004 BC. There's an article written by an old Princeton professor who tries to show that these genealogies have gaps. And that we can't use these genealogies in that particular way, but that's the debate. Are there gaps? Are there not gaps? Is it significant that these genealogies are connected to length of life? And because they're connected to length of life, does that give us maybe more of a ground to connect them in some way to, to the age of the earth? I'm not totally convinced that the genealogies can be used conclusively for trying to come to some agreement on the age of the earth. But certainly, because the length of life is mentioned, if you're a young earth person, it certainly would undergird that particular perspective, even if you can't be very specific. But others would argue that there are gaps, maybe long gaps. So that's the debate that goes back and forth. I'll try to. I think Dr. Kelly in his book discusses this to some degree, and then I'll try to get that article that is written. Yes, sir.
Evidence of gaps. What you're saying, you would try to find what they are.
Well, that's.
Could it be the evidence of gaps?
That's the question, and that's because these seem so tight. Whereas you just have this person and this person, like you do in the gospel genealogies, there might be many, many, many years between this person. Is this person just a descendant of this person? But when they're so tight like this, that's where the question arises. Yeah. Yes.
What for you as far as how long you're going to get?
I don't really know.
Okay.
I don't really know. Certainly they're living a very long time, and that's probably due to the conditions before the flood, because after the flood, it seems like lifespans are much shorter. So I don't really have a good answer to that question. You know, when did the effects of age start to hit? Well, how old was Sarah in Genesis 12? You know, she how old was Sarah in Genesis 12? She was still a beautiful woman at that point. She might have been 55, 60. So we get into chapter 6, and we get into a major question, and that is, who are the sons of God? And I want to lay out for you three different Reformed scholars who take three different answers or have three different solutions to this problem. Let's look at Genesis chapter 6. We're still in the Toledot of Adam, which runs through chapter 6, verse 8. And we've had the genealogy of chapter 5. And chapter 6, verse 1, seems to be another summary statement, perhaps recalling the ominous situation at the end of the Cainite lineage. 6:1, it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them. The sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful. They took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. Let me go ahead and read a couple more verses. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants on the earth in those days. And also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, they were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. And then the Lord saw the wickedness, and this leads us to the flood. Now, one of the major issues in this passage, who are the sons of God? And I'd like to briefly review three Reformed scholars who have three different answers to this question, and then sort of talk about the strengths and their weaknesses. And I think the bibliography for each of these is given in your notes. The first view is from Van Gameren, used to teach at RTS Jackson, now teaches at Trinity. He wrote an article many years ago that argued that the sons of God in Genesis 6 are angels who take to themselves human wives, and the result of this union is the Nephilim Gibberim, the giants, who are born as a result of this union. So that's who the sons of God are. They are angels. The sin is the clear disregard for the ordinance of marriage that should entail two human beings. And the wickedness that's described is reason for the flood. And flood has to come because of the wicked conditions on the earth. Now, the strengths of Van Gameren's view. The exact phrase, sons of God, B'nei HaElohim in the Hebrew, is used in the book of Job, for example, to refer to angelic beings. Job talks about the hosts of heaven, the council that was there with Yahweh. And so, if you're looking on the linguistic level, this exact phrase, the sons of God, is used in Job chapters 1 and 2 to refer to angels. Van Gameren argues that his view would explain the apparent contrast in the two phrases, sons of God, daughters of men. Sons of God, angels, daughters of men, in the category of human beings, human females. He also, I think he does and others, might appeal to some New Testament passages. Obviously these are debated, but those who take this view might appeal to 1 Peter 3:19, Christ put to death in the flesh, made alive in the spirit, preached to, quote, spirits in prison who were disobedient in the days of Noah. Connection here with the days of Noah. Jude chapter 6, angels who did not keep their proper abode are mentioned. And so some would refer to these passages as supporting the angels, the sons of God, as being angels. Problems with Van Gamer's viewer questions, at least we might entertain, are angelic beings sexual? Can angelic beings enter into a sexual relationship without using, in some sense, another human body? What do you do with Matthew 22:30? Does that relate here at all? We will be, when Jesus tells the people he's talking to, we will be like angels who neither marry nor are given in marriage. Well, that doesn't totally answer the question, but what does it mean that we will be like angels who neither marry nor are given in marriage? Certainly in Sodom and Gomorrah, the angels appear in human form, if you remember. And the people of Sodom thought they were human beings and wanted to enter into a relationship with them, but that never does come about because of what the angels do to stop that. So that's the question. Can angels, without the use of a human body, enter into a sexual relationship? There also seems to be an emphasis on flesh. Basar is the Hebrew. In chapter 6, verse 3, and chapter 6, verse 12. Chapter 6, 3, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh. The emphasis on flesh, if you talk about angels, that introduces another line, if you will, another category other than flesh. Plus, it's interesting that nowhere up to this point in Genesis are angels talked about. So it doesn't totally destroy the argument, obviously, but this would be the first time that angels are mentioned, and you're not given much introduction to them up to this point. So the emphasis on basar, flesh, and the fact that angels have not been introduced are questions as well. And then people dispute the meaning of those New Testament passages. You can read Kyle and Dalich's commentary, who argues against those passages that we mentioned in the New Testament as supporting the view that the sons of God here are angels. That's Van Gemeren's view. Another view is Meredith Klein's view. He also wrote an article, I believe in the Westminster Theological Journal. He argues that the sons of God are earthly kings, dynastic rulers, who continue the progress of sin by producing a state of tyranny, corruption, and violence. So you have powerful kings, sons of God, powerful kings, who sort of pick up on the violence in chapter 4 and continue that violence. The sin, in this view, is related to marriage, and the sin is specifically polygamy and the development of harems. And the offspring of these marriages, these mighty dynastic rulers, the offspring are the mighty men of old, the Gibberim, warriors, Nephilim, giants, people who are powerful. The offspring of these dynastic kings are also very powerful and continue the violence on the earth at that time. Now, the strengths of Klein's view, the term God, we've talked about the term Elohim. We've said it can mean gods. In some contexts, it can mean God, especially in relationship to the God of Israel. The term can also refer to a ruler or a judge. It can have that meaning in reference to human beings. And so Psalm 82:1 would be an example of that. And so sons of God, in Klein's view, would be sons of these rulers. So that is possible to take Elohim in the sense of ruler and to refer this phrase to these dynastic kings. You know, dynastic is the descendants. You have kings, but they have descendants. It does sort of fit the context of Genesis chapter 4, where we saw the violence connected with Lamech, and you could argue that there is even more progression here in chapter 6 and make some connection with Lamech at the end of chapter 4. So more of that violence that we saw earlier. Some would argue that the phrase in chapter 6, they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. Some would argue that that could refer to, you know, the development of harems, just choosing wives of any that they wanted, and this could refer to the development of harems. That is possible. Some of the weaknesses of Klein's view. The term Elohim can mean rulers, but the phrase sons of Elohim is never used to refer to rulers. Or there's no evidence that groups of kings are called sons of God. So the specific phrase doesn't quite fit in that sense. Klein finds kingship and dynastic development in Genesis 4. And he sees a development from there to Genesis 6. I'm not totally convinced that dynastic development is already there in Genesis 4. So that's a minor issue. Klein does not deal with the corruption of the godly line. And how the wickedness in chapter 6 relates to the corruption of the godly line. He sort of avoids that whole issue. In the past, I used to have students read each of these articles and sort of do a summary review. And then sort of, I'd have students sort of state which view they lean toward. If they weren't convinced completely of either view. And a lot of students faulted Klein because he uses too much ancient Near Eastern material. And it's harder to evaluate that. But that's a minor thing, too. The third possibility is John Murray's view. It's an appendix, I believe, in his book, Principles of Conduct. His view is that the sons of God refer to the godly line of Seth, who intermarry with the ungodly line of the Cainites, the daughters of men. The sin relates to unholy marital alliances in that the godly line marries women from the ungodly line. This grieves God. Now, in the way Murray develops it, the Nephilim, the giants, are not necessarily related to the marriages. The Gibberim are, but the Nephilim aren't. But they are an example of how violence has spread on the earth. The strengths of Murray's view, he connects it to the context, which I think clearly shows a division of the human race into the godly and the ungodly line. And you can take the phrase, they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose, as sort of being a reference to indiscriminate choosing. That the godly line were not choosing their wives in a discriminating way, but were making their choice based on other things besides their commitment to God. Some of the weaknesses related to Murray's view: although God's people are called sons, the exact phrase "sons of God" is not used in the Old Testament to refer to the godly line, if you will. So that's an issue. Yes.
Is there another reference after this about the godly line in the Old Testament in that way?
I don't exactly know. In what way?
You're using this. How else in the Old Testament is the godly line referred to?
In other words, is there a term?
Right.
Up to this point, there really hasn't been one.
Right, I understand up to this point. Yeah. We go from here forward.
Israelites, children of Israel, sons of Israel. Before that, before the nation of Israel, I can't think of a phrase that would describe, you know, some of the patriarchs. I can't think of one. Maybe there is one. I'm just not thinking of it. Well, they really are. Although their history is a history of disobedience, they are the nation through which the Messiah will come. Now, you can narrow down into Judah and all that stuff, but they really are considered God's people, so I would put them a part of the godly line. So maybe your point is there's not another term other places. And we're not through working through all of this. Yes.
Thinking of what Kirk calls principles of biblical hermeneutics, I came under the influence of Endeavor and also under Jack Scott, who both took very different viewpoints. And when I began wrestling with this passage, I came down on Murray's position, so that's my position. But thing that I didn't see that the weakness here that you've got, would intermarriage with unbelievers be enough to bring about the flood? You know, that was one of the strengths that led me to follow Murray's.
Yeah, worse. I'll come back and address that.
Okay, so you really get that.
Oh yeah. This is when you think through each of these views, you know, someone has raised this as a possible weakness.
You know, that's helped me right now. When you say weaknesses, you're not saying it's a weakness, you're right. This is what it's
like. Right. Oh, I'm going to come back and evaluate all of them.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much.
No problem. Don't want to leave you hanging there. I don't think Murray explains the Nephilim very well. In his particular analysis of it. But let's evaluate these, and I don't know what order I evaluate these in your notes, but certainly Van Gameren wins the linguistic argument, if you will, because the exact phrase occurs over in Job chapter 1. However, I think there's a problem, a major problem, besides some of the other weaknesses we've mentioned. If these are angels and humans intermarrying with each other, and the result are these Nephilim, these giants, which I guess are a result of the union. The Nephilim reappear later in the book of Numbers. So if you're a part of the Israelites waiting to enter the land of Canaan, and you're reading this text, and you're reading about Nephilim as a result of the union of these sons of God and daughters of men, and the Nephilim are this result of angels and humans, then what are they doing there after the fall when everything's destroyed? You see, I think that's a major problem of Van Gemeren's view because the Nephilim show up later, after the flood. Now, they're either Nephilim, they're not connected to these Nephilim, a totally different thing, or, but you put yourself in the context of Israel reading this, and I do think that is a an argument that's the angelic view has to answer. Klein wins the ancient Near Eastern argument, okay? And his view explains the depth of violence. And it's very clear that Gibberim is a term that can refer to warriors, warriors and mighty people. But he doesn't deal at all with what I think is going on in Genesis up to this point, the two lines, and how this violence in chapter 6 relates to the godly and ungodly line. And so you come back to Murray, and he wins the contextual argument because I think his view does fit best in context. Some have accused Murray's view, not Murray per se, but Murray's view as being arbitrary, moving in Genesis 6:1 to just men in general, and then in 6:2 sort of narrowing that down to the godly line. But if you look at what's going on in context, you know, chapter 4, we've had the ungodly line separated. That's the line of Cain. We've come back at the end of chapter 4 and picked up the godly line with Adam, Seth, and then you have this genealogy of Adam, which I take as the godly line because you've got Enoch in there and you've got Noah in there. And chapter 5 ends, Noah was 500 years old. Noah begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now you've got the three sons of Noah that are going to be the foundation of the nations in Genesis chapter 10. Shem is going to be the son in which the godly line continues. And so I do think in context, you have this very clear there. And so when you come to talk about the sons of God, what is going to be your reference point? Well, if you look at it in context, it's those of the godly line that have just been talked about up through chapter 5. So I do think Murray wins the contextual argument, and that's sort of the view that I lean toward. I think Klein has some things about violence and stuff, too. You also put this in context of the children of Israel getting ready to go into the land of Canaan, and what's one thing God tells them when they go into the land of Canaan? Destroy all the Canaanites. Why? They will influence you. Do not intermarry with the Canaanites. That is a problem for Israel in the land of Canaan. That is a problem that comes up later in the book of Malachi. Pre-exilic, post-exilic, this is a problem all throughout Israel's history. You do not marry those who don't believe in Yahweh. And that's always the issue. It's not the racial component, as we see with Rahab and then Ruth. Ruth makes a commitment to Yahweh and marries Boaz. It's the fact that the Canaanites especially, the Israelites are to exterminate as a part of God's judgment, and they don't worship Yahweh. And they will lead you astray. And so this whole issue of marriage is very important all throughout the history of Israel. And it really does fit Israel on the verge of going into the land of Canaan. This would reinforce, look what happens when you intermingle and you become, and you're not separated from the Canaanites when unbelievers and believers begin to come together in this way. Look at the wickedness. Look at the result. So I think this reinforces some of the things that Israel is going to face as they get ready to go into the land of Canaan. Now there's another argument I make in your notes. And I don't push this too much. You have to be careful with an argument like this. But I talk about in your notes the fact that there are some places in Genesis where Elohim, the word for God, is used with an article. Now, Elohim doesn't need the article. The article is there on the phrase, the sons of God, B'nai, sons of Ha Elohim. Ha is the article of the sons of God. It's there in that phrase in Genesis 6. And Elohim is used with the article in some very interesting places in Genesis. And I have some of those listed for you in some contexts of non-believers. I think Genesis 20, chapter 20, verse 6, chapter 41, 25. Interesting, in 42, 18, Joseph says to his brothers, before they know who he is, I fear Ha Elohim. I fear be God. I fear God. You wonder if he's not sort of giving them some hint here by the use of the article there. But Elohim with the article, the God, is used also in context of difficulty. God tests Abraham, Jacob flees. It's used in context of blessing. Genesis 27, 28, Genesis 35, 7. It's used in context where the stress is on walking with God in the very context of Genesis 6. For example, Enoch in 5:22 walked with God. And God has the article. It doesn't need to have the article, but it has the article. And in 5:24. And so you come down to this phrase in 6:2, B'nai Ha Elohim. I'm just wondering, this fits the contextual argument that it just reinforces the idea here, perhaps, that these are the sons of the true God, the sons of the God. I think these other things also sort of support this particular view. So I think the context, and it's interesting when students read these articles, Murray always won. It's kind of interesting. I think part of it is because his argument is a little bit more straightforward than the other two articles, but I had the students always vote, and Murray always came out on top, for whatever that's worth. So, do you have any other comments or questions on that before we sort of focus a little bit more on chapter 6? All right, chapter 6, 1, we've already said, is a summary statement. Chapter 6, 2 talks about marriage based on attractiveness and indiscriminate choice. Chapter 6, verse 3 is significant where this statement occurs. My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years. There was debate about that last phrase. His days shall be 120 years. Is that a reference to the shorter life he has after the flood? Or is that a reference to the time period between now and when the flood will come? People take both of those views. Certainly after the flood, life spans do decrease. But where this occurs, verse 3, this comment is placed before the mention of the offspring, which shows that God is displeased with the union itself. And then you have in verse 4 the groups mentioned that we've already talked about, the giants and the mighty men of old, men of renown. The point of all of this is to show, which it goes on to say, the condition of the world prior to the flood. The depravity of humanity comes out clearly in verse 5. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Wickedness was great on the earth. The thoughts of his heart, it was inward. It was pervasive, only evil. And it was always, continually. So this is a verse that reinforces how bad it had come on the earth. And this section closes with a statement of what God is going to do. I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry, not harm, that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And the hope of deliverance is found in Noah. This is a bad situation. God is going to destroy the human race, except for one family, which will actually be the avenue for the human race to continue.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole for sale or for profit without express written consent. For information on how you may obtain a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree online, please visit us at virtual.rts.edu.